Welcome again to the Bardolatry Podcast, a podcast where we discuss all things Shakespeare. I'm Gabs.
I'm Olivia.
And Olivia, you will notice, is joining me via phone today. Yeah, we've discovered that matching up schedules is not as easy as we thought it would be. So rather than making her drive across two states, we are doing this by phone.
I appreciate it. So thank you in advance for your patience, listeners.
Yeah, and also if you listen to the first episode, you'll notice Katie is not here today because she also had a crazy schedule and was not able to join us. So it's just the two of us for today.
Yeah, Katie will be back next episode, we hope.
So this episode, we were originally planning on discussing Shakespeare and portrayals of the other, or racial issues, in The Tempest, Othello, and Titus Andronicus. But then we discovered that none of us had actually read Titus Andronicus. I just kind of vaguely knew that there was a character in it named Aaron who was a bad guy, who was supposed to be black, so I thought, oh, that's probably interesting. And then when we read Titus Andronicus, we realized that there's so much stuff going on in this play that we just wanted to talk about the madness that is Titus Andronicus.
It is crazy, and I'm really glad we are devoting an episode to it, because there's just so much to talk about in this play alone that I think we can definitely pair it with the other two plays later, but I think we really need to just kind of unpack this one first.
I agree, and one of the reasons I think this is important is because I think most people I've talked to know vaguely that Shakespeare wrote this really violent, bloody play. But as far as I know, no one I know has ever read it or studied it in class. And so I think it's important to talk about it in terms of just, hey, here's a play you've probably never read and why it's important to think about. Because I think teachers and schools have a tendency to kind of push the traditional Shakespeare canon and ignore the stuff that falls outside of it. But there's interesting just stuff to talk about in the less popular plays, too.
Definitely. And I think it's good to expand your knowledge of all of Shakespeare's work, especially this one and other early works, because as we talked about, this is one of the earliest works, especially for the tragedy that we have of him. I believe that's correct.
Deciding what order he wrote his plays in is basically impossible, but if you kind of try to follow the chronology as best you can, as far as we can tell, this is the first tragedy that he ever wrote. And one of the reasons I love looking at early plays is anyone who claims that Shakespeare didn't actually write his plays. If you look at this, you can actually see the development of the playwright. So if you can, you know, if Titus is his first tragedy, you can see a lot of the seeds of later tragedies in here, and then you can also see the elements of it that are kind of like a younger or a more beginning writer. And so I think it makes
totally
Shakespeare the person almost more human if you study these plays.
Definitely. And I think, like you said, it makes it a more viable argument that actually this one person did write these plays, because you can see the trajectory of his craft.
Yeah, and as far as we know, Titus Andronicus is the play that pushed him to stardom in Elizabethan England, so that's another reason I think it's important to think about.
I didn't know that. Cool.
Yeah, I was reading the introduction that I read to this play in the Arden Shakespeare, the edition that I have, it's like 100 pages long of introduction, so I didn't read all of it, but he talked about how Titus was really popular, and how the theater typically worked in Elizabethan England. A play would be really popular for a season, and then it would kind of just go away. But Titus Andronicus, they have actually found records that it was being performed 20 years after it was first put on stage. So this was like blockbuster, like, craziness as far as popularity goes.
I mean, can you blame it? There's so many things that happen in this play, and there's such craziness involved that I can imagine, like, this was the big thing, especially, I don't want to say, like, of special effects wise, I mean, like, people are falling and hands are getting chopped off and there's like a baby swap. Crazy stuff is happening.
If you basically just think of the most insane action film you've ever watched, it's kind of like that, but set in the 1500s.
I was gonna say, it's like a retelling of classical Roman myth or a few myths, and then like kind of like on Marvel's Avengers scale, with like maybe Troy gore or like 300 gore involved.
Yes, definitely.
So, it should be more popular than it is currently.
So I think that's kind of interesting if you think about how this is one of the least popular plays that we read, but it was one of the most popular plays that was ever performed on the stage. And one of the other things I thought was kind of interesting that I thought we could just open up the discussion with in terms of talking about Titus Andronicus is that a lot of critics over the years who like to think that Shakespeare wrote very sophisticated plays that never delve into dirty or unmentionable things, which is not true, think that Titus Andronicus is so violent and despicable that it's just, like, not worth watching, and that it's just so disgusting and such an offense to the senses that Shakespeare probably didn't even write it.
Yeah, I read about that argument, too. I have the Riverside Shakespeare second edition version of the play, and the preface is written by a scholar named Frank Kermode, and he brings up that exact argument. He talks about George Peeley and the Honor of the Garter, and this author apparently is a contender as the writer of this play, and that argument kind of stems around the one world word palament, and it's apparently based on the word pallium, and that because George Peeley coined this word, that it's possible that he wrote the play, or that he collaborated with Shakespeare and wrote the play, or that, like, Shakespeare came in and polished it after George Peeley wrote the outline, and that's kind of the only crux of the argument that scholars use to defend that particular line of thinking. But because a lot of scholars say that Peeley's writing wasn't as sophisticated as Shakespeare's is, that's not really an argument. But it is an interesting point that, you know, did Shakespeare write it? Didn't he write it? Is it too violent? Is it not sophisticated enough for him?
When you're thinking about, in terms of, you know, did he write the whole thing? Maybe not, because it has been proven that Elizabethan playwrights collaborated on just about everything, and that they considered, you know, lifting from each other was totally fine. And I think, I don't know exactly which ones of Shakespeare's off the top of my head, but I know that at least two of his plays have been more or less proven to have been co-authored by someone else. But if you, you know, say, okay, so this other author wrote Titus Andronicus, and then Shakespeare kind of came in and, like, cleaned it up a little bit. But I've seen a bunch of other essays, I have not read all of them, that's not really fair, because even though the play might be shocking and violent and different from other Shakespeare that you've read, it still has sophisticated and elevated language at times that shows that the writer wasn't just doing blood and gore. They also had some sophisticated stuff going on.
Exactly. And I think another thing, especially not only do playwrights of this time borrow from other playwrights or authors borrow from other authors, but Shakespeare also used a lot of sources for his text that I think maybe isn't in the readership conscious all the time, or that notion is kind of swept under the rug. Like, Romeo and Juliet was based on another story by the same name, and Hamlet came from another play based on the same name. And Titus Andronicus, or at least Commode says that the nearest source for Titus Andronicus was an 18th century chapbook. So
yes,
I think
I saw that too.
Yeah, I'm right. And I think it's important to think about the fact that the source material might have been more violent than Shakespeare had intended, and that's another kind of element of outside influence that might be at play when we think about these plays, and not all of it might have come out of Shakespeare's head. He could have elevated the violence, he could have downplayed it, but, you know, it might not have all been from him.
Yeah, that's an interesting point to make. When I was reading this introduction, another thing that I was reading was that if you think about Aaron in particular, who's kind of like the villain plotter in the play, his particular character kind of came from some other popular villains on stage at the time. He specifically referenced Marlowe's Jew of Malta, who is this, like, totally comic, over-the-top villain. So
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like, in addition to thinking about his sources and what he was pulling from, if you look at what else was on the stage at the same time that was popular, it would make sense for authors to kind of maybe use some of those same tactics so that people would go see their plays.
It's true. If it draws in a crowd for one playwright or for one play, why wouldn't it work for your play, too?
Yeah, and before you go around insulting Elizabethan playwrights, just look at superhero movies in Hollywood and try to claim movie makers do not do the same thing.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, they're just working for a particular genre, and, you know, tropes reappear, and themes are used over and over again, so it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, so earlier when you kind of compared this to the Avengers, maybe it is an even better comparison than you thought, because this was like the big blockbuster play, like the Avengers was kind of the big blockbuster movie that then spawned a ton of other stuff.
Exactly! Yay! My references are relevant.
Full circle!
And that is how you write a thesis, friends.
One other thing we wanted to mention before we kind of got into some of the specifics, we were talking about how this is kind of an early tragedy, and so you can see the evolution of the playwright. And this play contains a lot of themes and types of characters that show up in Shakespeare's later plays, which is another argument to make for him having actually written it.
Definitely. I don't know if you want to talk about Titus Andronicus as a character first, where I saw a lot of the kind of proto-other tragical protagonists in him, or if you want to talk about kind of the thesis of the play that you can see in other places.
Let's go ahead and just talk about Titus.
Okay. Well, I think we shared this idea that we saw a lot of Hamlet and King Lear in him, especially with the pseudo-madness scene.
Yes, definitely the pseudo-madness.
Kind of the third, well, I mean, he only has one daughter, but like that, the phrase, chaste, perfect daughter. And, I mean, the whole bloody tragedy at the end reminds me of both King Lear and a little bit of Macbeth, where kind of all of your main players are just wiped off the board, and you have kind of the side characters left at the end to bring the audience some closure, or at least talk about, you know, next steps for the world of the play.
Yeah, and honestly,
those were two huge strains.
Oh, sorry,
go ahead.
If you think about Hamlet, that play ends with a bunch of stabbing and poisonings as well, so
definitely
setting the tone.
Yeah, I saw a lot of Hamlet in Titus.
Yeah, Titus himself, one of the kind of odd things about Titus, I think, is that I thought he started the play kind of ridiculous, and it wasn't until about halfway through that he, like, really sank into full-out, like, tragic hero mode. But unlike, like in Hamlet and in King Lear and in Macbeth, they might start the play as, like, kind of jerks, but then halfway through and they're, you know, oh, my life is going wrong, they start seeing, like, how what they did kind of led, or at least the audience can see how what they did led to their situation. But Titus, I don't think, makes that transition as fully. He's kind of like, I don't really want to be emperor, you can be emperor, I'm gonna stab my son, and, like, my daughter gets attacked, and then, oh, my life is horrible. But, like, I think he's kind of missing the element, which makes him kind of like a proto-Lear or a proto-Hamlet. He's kind of missing that, like, full character arc, where in the middle of the play, when he's just like, my life is terrible, I was like, I don't know if I really sympathize with you, because I don't know what journey you've gone on yet.
Yeah, I definitely agree that I didn't really sympathize with him. I kind of find aspects of his situation really comical, and I think that's in part because of the way the play kind of sets it up, or there's kind of, like, some satirical aspects going on, but I definitely agree that his character trajectory is kind of more like a ripple than a wave, and I thought he was, like, a grade AF.
Oh, yeah.
Up until maybe, like, the end of Act 4, and I didn't even believe his madness. I mean, later in the play, when I think it's an aside that he's like, I know they're really them, I'm just pretending that I don't know that the Empress is standing right in front of me, I'm just pretending to be mad. But even that kind of moment, that could have been a moment full of pathos for his character. Like, he's so tragically out of it that he doesn't even recognize the people standing in front of him. You know, like, Macbeth says, it's a dagger I see before me passage, or Lear on the Heath, that kind of emotion behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree that it doesn't feel as heroically tragic. Oh, and I had one more thing. Oh, about Hamlet. The Titus and Hamlet, I think, share kind of the personality trait that they're more reactionary. They don't really take action. Mm, they're more reacting to... There's a lot with his uncle, but he doesn't really do a lot until Act 5. And I feel like Titus is the same way. He kind of reacts to what's going on to his family and what's going on in his life. And he talks about taking revenge against the Emperor, but nothing really happens until the final scene of the play.
Yeah, that's a good point. He kind of has the delayed revenge going on.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's because the other revenge storylines were, I thought, more interesting, and they're the ones that kind of set the rest of the play and Titus's ultimate act in motion. But it's interesting that he, if he is the protagonist, if he is the featured character in the title of the play, but he kind of seems to be put on the back burner while everyone else's revenge plots are kind of set up and carried out, and then he gets to carry out his final revenge.
Yeah, like a lot more bad stuff has to happen to him before he can finally, like... Because I think the thing about Hamlet that people just can't stop talking about is he knows from Act 1 the wrong that was done to him, who did it, and what he needs to do, and then he spends, like, 4 acts just kind of going, I don't know when I'm going to do this. Whereas Titus, you know, in Act 1, like, his son gets killed, and then his daughter gets assaulted, and her tongue gets cut out, and then another couple of his sons get beheaded, and then his own hand gets cut off, and, like, all this stuff until he's finally like, all right.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Kind of without the cooking gear, like, Tamora going down. Tamora.
I don't know how you say it. Tamora.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Tamora. We'll
okay.
go with that.
All right. Good. So,
if we're wrong, one can please correct us in the comments, but for now we're sticking with Tamora.
Yes. Yeah. Please feel free to correct anything that we are screwing up in pronunciation. And then one other point that you made that I thought that was good to just point out is how the other thing about Act 5 of this play that's similar to Hamlet or even Macbeth is that, like, after kind of this orgy of stabbing is over and everyone's dead, you have, or even King Lear, like, you have the son who's surviving, so, you know, like, Edgar and King Lear, or I guess you don't have a son surviving, but, like, Horatio and Hamlet, and Lucius in this play, and then, like, also kind of the general type. So I think, like, Fortinbras comes in at the end of Hamlet, and he's, like, the general's son.
I was just thinking about that, because that reminds me of the Goths, how they just kind of come in, like, what happened here? Why is everyone dead?
I guess we'll take over now, if that's cool.
Basically.
And everyone's like, yeah, all right. So speaking of the Goths marching in at the end, let's go ahead and move into issues of race and otherness.
Sure.
We kind of have two things going on here. So, like, the really big crux of the play is the Romans versus the Goths. Titus returns in Act 1 after, what was it, like, 10 years war against the Goths, where he's, like, finally defeated them and is victorious. And he's,
yeah, something.
I think it's 10, because I think I read it was, like, an Iliad allusion there.
I was just thinking that. I was like, it's like the Odyssey and, like, the Iliad, and, like, these big, sweeping, epic battles.
Yeah.
Where, like, you don't see any bloodshed, and then, like, the main guy comes home completely unscratched.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, another reference to the Iliad. So Titus returns from 10 years at war. He has the Queen of the Goths and her sons with him, and then he has his 4 remaining sons. And he makes this speech about how he had 25 sons, but 21 of them were killed in this war, which is half the number of sons that Priam had, the king of Troy. He had 50 sons who were all killed in war. So, you know, not as much as that, but still. I was like, how do you have 25 kids? Good lord.
Oh my god, yeah. And we don't even mention Titus' wife. I feel bad for her if they're all hers. Like, oh my god, that's a lot of children.
Yeah, she's probably dead from childbirth.
Yeah.
Either that or he had, like, 4 wives.
I mean, probably.
Yes.
Let's be real here.
Yeah, so you have this, you know, Romans versus the Goths thing set up where you have, you know, the noble Romans, everyone knows Rome and, like, the classical tradition and all of that stuff, and then you kind of have these invader Goths who are considered barbarous, terrible people that aren't sophisticated. But I think, and this play doesn't really delve into it a great deal because it spends so much time just kind of on the murder and mayhem. But if you think about Tamora setting off this whole chain of revenge plots, it basically comes from the Romans being barbarous to her and lopping one of her sons into pieces and throwing him into a fire when she was begging for them to spare his life. And then she's like, fine, screw you guys. I'm going to start killing y'all off.
And it's interesting that you mentioned, like, the barbarism of the other, because she even says, I think actually it's one of her sons that says, was never Scythia half so barbarous. So it's the idea of kind of the Rome and the other, but Romans that we're supposed to see as, like, the upstanding kind of guardians of goodness are the ones that are setting these chains of events in motion by doing these terrible things, or these extremely kind of vicious and gruesome things that don't need to be done. I mean, she says, you know, you have us where you want us. We have sworn loyalty to you. You've taken us over. Why do you have to kill my eldest son? And I forget Titus's answer, but he's basically like, that's because that's the way it has to be.
Yeah, he just kind of like, cuz.
Exactly. Like, I feel bad for you, but it's still going to happen. Like,
yeah.
You know,
so I think that kind of sets up an interesting question right off the bat of, like, who really is the barbarous one here? And when we get into talking about the women of the play a little more, I would argue that Tamara is not so much evil or a villain because of the fact that she's a goth, but more because she's the wrong type of woman.
Yeah, they make that very clear.
Yeah. So in terms of the goths, one of these, this interesting thing I read, again, in this introduction to The Art in Shakespeare written by Jonathan Bate, he talks about how if you think of Titus Andronicus being a play that is set in ancient Rome, but also in Elizabethan England, then you'll see that what Shakespeare's doing is not demonizing the Goths, even though it seems that's what he's doing, because in Act 5, when the Gothic army moves in to take over Rome, they're actually super sophisticated and shocked by everything that's going on. The argument that he made that the Goths were kind of just this generalized, to Elizabethan England, the Goths were just kind of like all of the tribes in Europe at the time. And because they moved up into England and ended up settling England, the English people would have considered themselves ancestors of the Goths. So he made the argument that at the end of the play, the Goths are moving in and throwing over the hedonism of these terrible Romans who are just all murdering each other. And you can also consider Elizabethan English people as having overthrown this hedonistic yoke of the Catholic Church, because this was not too long after England separated from the Catholic Church. So you kind of have the Goths and the Elizabethan English both overthrowing Rome. So he's kind of making a point that they might be the other, but I think that the Elizabethans were actually supposed to root for the Goths at the end of the play.
Yeah, and that's why, actually, it makes me think of maybe this is another reason why this was such a blockbuster hit, because the audience saw themselves in, ultimately, the heroes of the play,
mm-hmm.
who kind of come in and just say, like, well, tyranny is over, all of the bad guys are killed, let us rejoice and move forward and establish something better. So I wonder if that's the case, if we should read this at least from their perspective as a tragedy at all. I mean, I know there are lots of tragic elements, and it is a tragedy because our hero dies and a lot of the other main players of the play die, but given that kind of perspective of positive kind of projection into the future, maybe this ending isn't quite so tragic.
Yeah, you could almost imagine, like, a similar movie set in the U.S. ending with, like, everyone chanting, like, USA! USA! Like, it's kind of that,
Happy Caroline.
The patriotic swell of,
yeah, like there's this camaraderie mentality at the end, like we will prevail and all of the like tainted blood is out of the population.
Yeah.
The Goths as a group, Tamara and her sons aside, are like kind of cool, upstanding people. They hear Lucius out when he goes to them and they're like, yeah, we'll come campaign for your cause. We're totally invested in making sure that the good guys win. We don't mind helping you out, even though you just kind of came in for 10 years and ravaged us. Yeah, we'll help you.
Yeah, after you, like, beat the crap out of us for 10 years, no problem.
Like, we come bearing gifts and flowers. Everything's cool.
I would say the most interesting character who associates with the Goths in this play is Aaron, who is officially given the title of Aaron the Moor, which I guess is supposed to mean that he's Muslim somehow, even though Islam didn't exist yet.
Yeah, I feel like that title's used in other plays throughout Shakespeare, but I didn't actually look up exactly what it would have meant for Elizabethan.
I know Moor was one of the words they used for Muslim, but I think if you read Othello, it like kind of means Muslim, and it also kind of means not white, so I'm not 100%. If someone wants to tell us we're being idiots, please feel free. But it is very clear that Aaron is a black character because it's mentioned multiple times. The interesting thing about Aaron is he is such an unrepentant villain. And speaking of seeing, you know, things that pop up again in later plays, Aaron is very much like an Iago type. But he's like almost almost even more evil than Iago, I would argue, because Iago kind of spends the whole play carefully crafting how he's going to get Othello to, like, finally commit this murder. And Aaron's just like, hey, you dudes should totally attack Lavinia and cut her hands off. And they're like, yeah, that sounds awesome. And then he's like, I'm going to have these dudes fall into a pit and get them murdered for the murder of a guy that I killed instead. And, like, he's eviler on a larger scale.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's also not just, as you just pointed out, it's not just one kind of action or one plot. He has a bunch of little, like, killing people to not only, I guess, get some satisfaction out of the actions that he's helping commit or just further other people's goals. Like, Demetrius wants Lavinia, so he's like, here's the perfect scheme, go do that. So I guess he's kind of like the every villain, or he's maybe like the bad shoulder angel. That's like, you can relate to this. Like, get what you want because I would do it this way.
I love that idea of Aaron as the bad shoulder angel, the little shoulder devil.
Yeah, just like on someone's shoulder, like, hey, go kill her. And everyone's like, cool.
All right, yeah, I'll go do that.
So yeah, he's like the every villain, I guess, in a sense, that he's not just furthering his own agenda, he's helping other people commit crimes for the satisfaction of doing it.
Yeah, it seems like his main motivation is just because he likes causing mayhem. And in Othello, we never know exactly what is driving Iago, but people have come up with all sorts of theories of why he, like, concocted this revenge. But in Titus Andronicus, it's more just like, you know what, I think it'd be cool if you murdered those people, or I think it'd be hilarious if I convinced someone to cut their hand off. I don't know if you've ever heard this term before, Olivia, but there's this term referring to villains called magnificent bastard.
I feel like it sounds familiar, but I wouldn't be able to place where I'd heard it if I have, but I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's the villain who's just, like, so evil and so happy to be evil, but is, like, so fun to watch that you actually really like them, even though you know they're a total douche. They reach this magnificent bastard standing where you just can't wait to see, like, what they're gonna do next, and I think Aaron is, like, a perfect example of this. He has one of the most fantastic speeches in the play in Act 5. They finally capture him and get him to admit all these crimes that he committed. And Lucius asks him if he's sorry for what he did. And he has this whole speech about how he's only sorry that he didn't do more bad stuff. And
yeah.
My favorite example of what he has done in his life is he talks about how he has dug up dead people from their graves, gone and set them at their friends' doors with a letter around their necks that says, "Let not your sorrow die, though I am dead." And then he basically, like, knocks on the door and runs away.
That is, like, the most extreme version of Ding Dong Ditch I've ever heard, and I love it.
I was like, that is the most bizarre, meanest thing you can do to somebody.
Oh, man.
Like, I'm gonna leave your dead friend on your doorstep.
Also, that would take a lot of, like, planning and research, finding the right friend, making sure you're putting the right corpse at their house.
Yeah, looking at the person's address, like, figuring out how long they've been, like, yeah, there's a lot of planning that goes into that.
Yeah, that's, like, meticulous villainy. I like it.
So I did want to point out really quick with Aaron, I just thought this was interesting, that there's, like, a couple of famous adaptations of Aaron in, adaptations of Titus Andronicus. In the 1600s, like late 1600s, during the Reformation, like once the theaters opened up again and all that stuff, there was a playwright, I have his last name, Ravenscroft, and he took Titus Andronicus and adapted a little bit. One of the really interesting things that he did is he put more Aaron in the play. So he, like, had him speak a little sooner, and then he actually introduced the child earlier in the play to kind of give Aaron this little bit of humanity really early on, and then made like all these other little tweaks to kind of make Aaron a little more complicated as opposed to just like straight up villain. And then at the end of his version of the play, Tamora actually stabs and kills their child. And this is really, really bizarre, but Aaron eats the child. But it's not like a weird cannibal, like, look at this terrible person moment. It's like he eats the child to save it from its mother, even though she already killed it. I don't remember exactly what the explanation was. He was talking about how just this interpretation really humanizes and rounds Aaron out, because people during the Reformation would have really delighted in seeing a really complicated villain. And I just thought that was a really interesting way to go out about the play, because I do think Aaron is one of the most fun parts of it. So I think that version sounds really cool.
I especially love the ending with eating the child. My first thought was all of the classical references to people serving children to other people, both for revenge purposes and for kind of pious religious purposes. And I guess it reminds me most of Tantalus more than it would Philomena and Procne and Tyrius, although I can imagine why that would be in there because of that play. And there are so many references, myth or story, I guess. And how there are so many references to that story in Titus Andronicus to begin with, that it does make a lot of sense. Ravencroft? Is that the...
Yeah, Ravenscroft.
Ravencroft. I like it. That Ravencroft would include that final parent-eating child moment. It's really interesting. It's super complicated, and I really like that idea.
Yeah.
So if it's classical, or if it has a bigger, deeper statement. Because I feel like when we're talking about the other, there are kind of the degrees of the other. Because you have the Romans on one end of the spectrum, and then kind of the Goths are in the middle. They're other enough, but they're not too other. And then you have Aaron by himself at the far end of the spectrum that they kind of compartmentalize as very other.
Yes.
Compared to the Romans. And the Goths are kind of that middle ground, the go-between of the spectrum.
Yeah, because they, are different in culture, but not necessarily different in looks.
Right. Back to the eating of the child, I guess it was keeping the other, or keeping, like you said, the child away from the mother, who might be other compared to Aaron, because even though she's, Tamara's on the other spectrum, she wanted to have the baby killed from the get-go. So it's and maybe it goes back to the whole bad woman thing.
Yeah.
That it's you being with the father is even better than you being with this villainous woman who's willing to kill you.
Killing your own child is usually not a good thing, so...
Well, Titus gets away with it twice.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, that's why I said usually. Although, I would argue him killing his children in this play is good neither one of the times he does it.
I agree. I totally agree.
So, speaking of Tamara as being the evil woman, let's go ahead and talk about women in this play, because there's a lot going on with them, too.
Oh, man, so much. And classical allusions and references abound, which I love. But I don't even know if you want to start with, the pious, chaste Lucretia-type woman, or do you want to start with the bad tiger of a woman, as they call her, I think, at the very end.
Let's go ahead and talk about Lavinia, just because we haven't really yet, and kind of think about her and what's going on with her.
There's a lot... Reference-wise, with her story, storyline-wise, her narrative mirrors a lot of the Philomena Procne Tyrius play, and then there's also the Rape of Lucretia that's thrown in there.
Yes.
I mean, of course, at the beginning, at the beginning she treated property, but go ahead, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that, one important thing to keep in mind with Lavinia is that she is kind of supposed to be, the perfect Roman woman. So if you have read Antony and Cleopatra, Octavian's sister kind of plays the same role, where she's very docile, kind of does what the men decide. They say, you're going to marry this person, and she's like, great. And they're like, no, you're going to marry this person, and she's like, good. Even though she's allegedly in love with Bassanius, or however you say his name.
Yeah, I think it's Bassanius.
And there's another really big thing, which is the idea of the chaste and honorable woman, which we are all very familiar with that trope. But Rome actually took it to this kind of extreme where you mentioned the story of the Rape of Lucretia. She was this woman in Roman history who was married, and she, a general, I think, or was it the emperor himself or the emperor's son? I don't remember which.
I feel like she was married to the emperor's son, and it was... Tarsus,
Yeah, or she was married to a general, and it was, like, the Emperor's son who raped her?
Yeah. She's definitely royal through marriage in some way, but she is also married to a general, I feel.
Yes.
Because it's all the soldiers who are like, my wife is chased, let's go check on our women and see what they're doing.
Yeah, honestly, the soldiers were having a bragging contest about, like, whose wife was the most chaste, and it turned out Lucretia was the most chaste. She was just sitting there sewing with her maids, being wonderful, and so, of course, this, like, complete asshole is like, oh, I have to, like, ruin her now. So he gets invited over, and he ends up raping her, and Lucretia, because, like, her honor has been so besmirched, she manages to send out word to her husband so that this guy will get punished, and then she stabs herself to death, and she was upheld as this, like, virtuous example of what you should do, because she knew, like, all, it should be said, all of the men in her life were like, it's fine, it wasn't your fault, we forgive you, like, we don't think of you as any less, but she was like, no, my honor has been ruined forever, there's no way I can fix it, I have to kill myself, and then all young Roman women were just taught that they should be this wonderful, upstanding portrait of virtue like Lucretia.
Mm-hmm. And that's what gets me the most, is that the men are like, no, it's okay. And she's like, no, I can't do it. I have to die.
And, you know, maybe she had reasons of just, I can't live with such horror, I have to kill myself. But the way the Romans definitely framed it was all, like, from a virtue standpoint. So if you think about, Lavinia's basically like a stand-in for Lucretia. As Olivia mentioned, there are tons of classical references that basically just, like, say outright, hey, your story is a lot like Lucretia's story.
They even have her, they have Lavinia's nephew, the young Lucius, like, reading Ovid.
Yeah.
And she picks up the book and, like, starts flipping through the pages, and you're like, oh, look, classical evolution, right in the text. And it does kind of point out, because you mentioned the whole Iliad kind of epic story reference, Lavinia is actually the name of the daughter of the emperor that Aeneas visits when he's going to found Rome, and she's the one that Aeneas marries.
Oh, yeah.
Which I, because I was like, I know this is a classical name from somewhere, I have to look it up, so I looked it up, and that's what Wikipedia told me. I was like, oh, that's right! So it's, I guess, kind of the other, like, the chaste Roman, her roots are Roman.
Yes, she's so Roman.
The mother of Rome, yeah.
Yeah.
And she was also perfect, and I'm sure bore Aeneas many children, at least a few sons.
Yeah. Once you set Lavinia up as this, then tearing her down just becomes, like, something that an audience can see right away. Like, this is horrible what was done to her. Not only because what was done to her is, like, mind-blowingly awful and, like, the worst thing you could ever do to someone, but it's even worse because she was so chaste and perfect. That's something the men in the play talk a lot about, is like, oh, but she was so chaste and they attacked that. And I'm like, yeah, but they also cut off her hands, and it doesn't really matter how chaste she was. That's not okay.
Yeah. And they cut out her tongue.
Yes.
And also, it's like, Lucretia was also married, but it's like, she was married. It wasn't as if she was chaste, but it wasn't as if she were virginal as well. That part, I'm like, well, okay. Chaste is chaste, I suppose. She was a devout wife.
Yeah, yeah. If you're a loyal wife, that's still chaste. If you know the story of Lucretia and these other references, then in the last act, when Titus ends up stabbing her and killing her, he's trying to do what these mythic stories did, where, you know, we figured out who did this to her, we punished them, and now that everyone's been punished, then she's of no use anymore because her honor has been besmirched, so I'm going to do the nice fatherly thing and stab her to death, according to him, I guess.
That's what fathers do.
Apparently.
Yeah. Apparently.
There's a lot of stuff going on here, like the implication that after someone sexually assaults you, then you're basically just worth getting killed because you're ruined forever, which is a horrible message.
Oh, it's atrocious. Definitely something you don't want to teach anybody ever. Ever.
Yeah, it's real bad.
But that's Rome for you. Oh, well.
Yeah. We're never going to claim that Rome was, like, an upstanding moral example of wondrous gender relations.
Never. not at all.
So one of the things I thought was interesting with Olivia, or, geez, you are Olivia, sorry, Lavinia.
I'm interesting. I'll claim that I'm interesting.
You are interesting, but you are not in this play.
Thank you. No, I'm not. I'm in 12th Night, though.
You are. So one of the interesting things about Lavinia is that this happens to her fairly early on in the play, and most of her role is silent. She speaks very little before this attack. And so I think acting the part of Lavinia would be really interesting because you would have to rely entirely on action and your relationships with the other people on stage without talking.
Absolutely.
And I was reading something. So there are like two particular productions of Titus Andronicus that everyone points to when they talk about Lavinia. So I'll just name drop them really quick. There was a 1955 version, I believe, directed by Peter Brooks, starring Laurence Olivier as Titus Andronicus, and Vivien Leigh played Lavinia. And in that version, they went for like a very interpretive, theatrical setting where when she comes out for the first time after her attack, she has these long red ribbons coming out of the arms of her gown to, you know, symbolize all this blood, but it's done in a very, like, theatrical way, where, like, the intensity is pumped up, but it's not supposed to be super realistic. And then there was a 1985 version, I don't remember who it was directed by, but it was starring Brian Cox as Titus Andronicus and Sonia Ritter as Lavinia. And that version went for the super realism, where they attached these prosthetics to Sonia Ritter, to the actress, so that it actually looks like she has stumps, and they, like, splashed a bunch of stage blood on her. So when she comes out, it looks like she actually had her hands chopped off.
That's a little terrifying.
Yeah, and it was interesting to think about, like, these two different ways you could go, but I thought it was interesting because in this 55 version with Vivien Leigh, like, if you look up pictures, like, her gowns are really flowing and beautiful, and, like, these ribbons, you know, what happened to her is awful, but it's kind of this beautiful interpretation, and she has this full face of, like, very kind of elaborate makeup on, whereas the version with Sonia Ritter is, like, her hair's been cut really short, and it's, like, she's wearing basically, like, a burlap sack, and it's just super stark. And I think that's interesting because I think probably the Vivien Leigh version that's more theatrical is more what the play, like when I imagine this play being produced, I would imagine it being kind of more of the interpretive, over-the-top sort of theatrical version. But apparently this more realistic version just totally shocked audiences. I thought that was, like, really interesting how you could turn it to go two different ways.
Yeah, and I think that potential is there for the play as a whole. Like, I was saying that there were very comic moments from you when I was reading it, and that if I saw, like, the Monty Python version of Titus Andronicus, it would be hilarious, kind of dark comedy-ish.
Yeah.
So there's that interpretation in there. Then I think you have to remember that, you know, when you're reading about all this blood and gore, it might be easier to kind of compartmentalize or gloss over, like, okay, and his hands get chopped off, and his hands get chopped off, and oh yeah, he gets stabbed. But then to see it in such a stark way as you've described, I think really plays up the tragedy and the horror of the actions. And I think we can be in the sympathetic, tragic element more.
Yeah, it's almost like usually when you see action movies where, like, people are getting killed left and right, you're just like, oh, whatever, this is entertaining. But then, like, if you actually stop and think about that happening, then it's horrifying.
Right.
And it's interesting because I don't think of this play as being portrayed in a psychologically real way. But if you think about, especially, like, sexual assault is such a talked about topic in the modern day. And, like, whereas I think you can still get away with, like, making stabbings hilarious, you can't really get away with making Lavinia's situation hilarious in any way.
Yeah, agreed.
So I feel like as a director, that would be a very difficult scene to figure out how you wanted to portray and interpret that and how you could fit it in with, like, the rest of your vision for the play.
That's very true. And I would go so far as to say dangerous to portray Lavinia's storyline in a comic or lighthearted way to match the tone of the other lighthearted things that happen in the, or not lighthearted, but the more comic things that happen in the play. And actually, that reminds me a lot of the problem comedy Measure for Measure. And I don't know how close that was written to Titus Andronicus, but you can see a lot of parallels with those two, where there's very comic moments, but there's also very dark, dangerous moments, like this, like Lavinia's storyline and Isabel's storyline, and they match.
So according to the very rough chronology I have in front of me, they think Measure for Measure was written after Twelfth Night and Hamlet, and just before Othello. So it's actually one of his much more... one of his later plays.
Interesting. Okay.
Just a fun fact. We'll talk about Measure for Measure at a later date.
Yes. Can't wait. I love that play.
So, in contrast to Lavinia, we have Tamora, who we already mentioned, Queen of the Goths, and sets out this whole revenge scheme because they killed her son, her eldest son, even though she begged for him to be saved. But the kind of interesting thing about Tamora is that despite the fact that the Goths, like, as a people, get a pass, you know, they become, like, the noble saviors at the end, kind of, Tamora herself gets no reprieve, and in fact, let me double check to make sure my memory is correct, I believe the very last lines of the play are about how she shouldn't get a proper burial.
No mournful bell shall ring her burial, but throw her forth to beasts and birds of prey.
Yep, her life was beastly and devoid of pity, and being dead, let birds take on her pity. And then the play ends. So the play ends with them saying, throw Tamora to the wolves, who cares? She was a horrible beast. Which is, well, it infuriated me personally, but...
No, I totally agree. It's like, come on.
If everyone else is going to get a pass in this play, for, like, get a proper burial in this play for all the horrible things they did, then she should also.
Right. Like, I thought you set up Aaron as the comic main villain of the story. Why is suddenly Tamora getting all of the blame for everything awful ever?
Yeah, and I mean, granted, she also does some very horrible things, but so does everyone else. So that makes her seem less like she deserves it, because if everyone else is stabbing and killing people and plotting and all this stuff, then what she does doesn't seem that out of the realm of,
right,
you know, like makes her go into evil. So we think that the main reason that Tamora does just become this main focus of scorn is because she is the opposite of Lavinia. So instead of being the perfect, pious Roman woman, she is the sexual, has sex out of wedlock for fun, taking what she wants sort of woman.
Yeah, she's like the deviant in this spectrum of perfection. Thus, she gets all the blame ever.
And I thought it was really wild how, at the end of the play, so she ends up giving birth to Aaron's child. We've already discussed Aaron. And everyone immediately knows it's his because the baby is half black. And they use this baby at the end of the play not to... because Aaron basically sacrifices his life to save the life of his kid, which to some degree does at least humanize him a little bit. Although he then, you know, says, I regret every good deed I ever did. So he's not... not that relatable.
Like, that's the only good deed you ever really did, but okay.
But I thought it was very interesting that they used this child in the last act to point to it and go, look, here's proof that Tamora was immoral and that anything bad you say about her is probably true because she had this kid out of wedlock. And then you're just supposed to think that she's a horrible person. I kept thinking, well, you know, she got married to an emperor that she didn't love who defeated her people, and we don't really know about much about that, about her relationship with Aaron, but she seemed to at least like him a lot, so I found it shocking just how much that was used against her as proof of her, like, moral inferiority.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it seemed, at least to me, I mean, aside from her plotting in the woods with Aaron early, and I think about Act 2, in at the beginning of the play, I really sympathized with her. I mean, yes, the play sets her up as other, and yes, Titus is supposed to be the hero, but you feel for her when she begs for her son's life. And then as soon as she has this child, you know, all sympathy you're supposed to feel for her is just supposed to be tossed out the window because she's suddenly this beastly, atrocious being that doesn't deserve your sympathy.
Yeah, and I also think earlier in the play, too, because she knows what her sons are going to do to Lavinia and does nothing to stop it.
That's true. That's true. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Which is a very unsympathetic moment for her, but the reason I think it's supposed to be so unsympathetic is because Lavinia appeals to her as a woman, and she just says, no, I'm not interested. And being a woman and turning her back makes her even worse than she would have been if she was a man, because she's, like, denying this, like, woman. What's supposed to be kind of this, like, womanly connection. Yeah. I mean, I think anyone who did that would be a horrible, horrible human being. But I think it's, like, it's further proof of how bad Tamara is compared to Lavinia's goodness.
I wonder why they didn't keep that as, like, the main focus of why she could be villainized. I mean, because that there in itself is enough to kind of carry through the play. And couple that with all of the killing and revenge plotting.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they didn't have to go in the whole, like, and she also had a kid, which makes her awful.
Yeah, by the way, never mind that she knew that her sons were going to cut off this woman's hands. She had a baby, and she's a bad person.
Which is just 10 times worse than assisting in this plot.
Apparently.
Yeah. Clearly, Romans have their priorities straight.
Clearly. Yeah, I think no matter which way you look at it, I would say the women in this play, I think being those characters could be a very interesting challenge as an actor, but I think that, mm-hmm. like, the characters themselves both definitely get the shaft in different ways, and not just, like, you know, because they get, like, murdered or whatever, but just, like, their characters in general. If you are the good woman, then you're, like, stuck in this life doing what everyone tells you to do, and if you're the bad woman, then you're, like, an immoral beast, so.
Exactly. And even, like, even the nurse doesn't get it much better, because she's only in the play for about three, maybe, like, half of a column of text, and then Aaron kills her.
Yeah.
To be fair, like, in the moment, I thought it was kind of just with the brusqueness that he does it, I laughed a little bit, like, okay, Aaron. But, in retrospect, it's awful. But she's delivering him this news, and then he's like, oh, well, okay, three of you know. Now only two of you know.
Yep.
Taken care of.
Three people can't keep a secret. Yeah, I have to admit that every time I was reading this, and it just said, like, so-and-so kills so-and-so, I usually just laughed because it was all, like, so sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Like, two people would be talking, and suddenly someone was, like, stabbing another person and killing them. I was like, where did that come from?
When Bassani is dead, I was like, oh, okay, he's dead, all right.
Or when Titus stabbed his son in the first act, and at first I didn't think he had actually done it, because it was just, he's like, no, Dad, you can't get through this door. And he's like, fine, stab. I was like, what is happening?
And that is the beginning of chaos. And it's his son. It's like, that's your kid, really?
Yeah, and then he, like, doesn't want him to get buried in the proper burial manner and all of this crazy stuff. Like, Titus, that really, when he stabs his son basically for no reason and then doesn't want him to get a proper burial, that's when I was like, all right, dude, like, you're a little worse than Lear, I think.
Yes, I think so. For a lot of reasons. that being one of them.
Yeah.
I think one.
So, to wrap this up, I just wanted to have a quick discussion of whether we liked the play, whether we bought the characters, what we thought about it compared to other tragedies Shakespeare has written, and whether we think it's worthy of study.
Yes to the first, yes to the last, and pretty much yes to all of the above. I really liked this play. I think it's super interesting, and having read it for the first time, I would recommend it to anyone looking to broaden their knowledge of Shakespeare or learn more about the trajectory of his work as a playwright. I think it's also useful for study because, as we've mentioned, it kind of points to the direction Shakespeare took with later plays, especially tragedies. I don't know if I bought the character so much as I looked for the references from other works that I knew in kind of the grander mythos of Roman ideology and saw them as reflections of that. So I guess I bought them in that respect, that I saw their storied ancestors and saw how Shakespeare worked with those themes. But I don't think they're as real, especially not Titus, as a tragic hero. I didn't really buy him at all as a tragic hero.
Yeah, I was gonna say
as a precursor.
Yes. They're almost more archetypes in this play than they are people.
Definitely.
And I think that's one of the things that allows the play to move at the pace that it does. Is like, if you just want something fun, which I know, like, when you're talking about all this horrible death and destruction, like, you're like, how is this play fun? But honestly, it's just like, if you just want to see a bunch of gore happening quickly, this is a great play because the characters don't stop and pause too long. And I think the reason a lot of his other plays have lasted for so many years is because of the characters are so psychologically real that even though Hamlet was written 500 years ago, you can still see ways to believe him as a person 500 years later. Whereas I'm not convinced even the Elizabethans related with these characters.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was Shakespeare's intention. I actually really enjoyed the play. I would say if you are just looking for the very sophisticated stage Shakespeare, you don't want to read this. Or maybe you do to, like, learn that Shakespeare did not only write boring, sophisticated people. But I don't think he had the time to flesh anyone out. He was just like, you know what? I want all this stuff to happen, and they can't think about it too long or else they'll stop murdering each other. So plow forward.
I think, actually, now that you mentioned, because I also love the play, and I think it might be even a good starter play for, I'm thinking, like, in high school. Instead of reading Romeo and Juliet, give the kids Titus Andronicus.
Everyone loves Shakespeare.
It's like, Shakespeare's funny and awesome, and he makes jokes. Like, there's puns in here, there's so many funny things. I guess we think are supposed to be funny. I'm not sure. I'm sure it was Shakespeare's intention. Because, you can't have multiple people falling in a ditch and not think it's funny. It's just funny.
Just, like, randomly falling into a ditch.
Yeah. Or you think that's, like, the third person to stop.
Can you imagine how many permission slips you would have to get signed?
Oh, my God.
To read Titus Andronicus with a group of students under the age of 18? Like, oh my gosh, I think there would be, like, a riot.
I think so. Yeah, there are so many sensitive, delicate topics in here. There's, you know, there's blood, there's gore, there's violence, there's sexual abuse and assault and rape and all of these things that, yeah, I think it would be probably more of a headache than it's worth, but it would be funny to see younger audiences react to Shakespeare with just joy, rather than thinking that they have to slog through it, because it's not meant to be slogged through, it's just meant to be absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not this play, but maybe a play like this.
And I also just think it's interesting, it's an interesting condition of people that for 500 plus years, people have looked at Titus Andronicus and just been like, this play is a lot of fun. And the only people haven't been like, that is horrifying. Because even when it's not produced very often, but some of the productions that I mentioned, critics claimed to be shocked by them and said the play was horrible and people shouldn't go see it. And, like, people would faint during the play because of the violence. But
Wow. The
runs were always completely sold out every night. So it just goes to show that this is the kind of stuff that people go and see.
Even if they are horrified by it. It's true, like, horror movies, they're not recognized in big award shows. Like, I don't think a horror movie has ever been given an award at the Academy Awards, the Emmys, or whatever. But they're all the theaters are always packed. You know, know, they always do really well. And I mean, it's, you know, it's something that resonates maybe with our human nature. I don't know what that says about us as human nature, being violent and wanting to see gore and stuff. But I don't know. I mean, Shakespeare knew what he was doing, clearly.
Yes. And, you know, without Titus Andronicus, maybe we never would have gotten the later plays to have been preserved for so many years, because not as many people have gone and seen his stuff without Titus, so.
That's true. I mean, every playwright has to start somewhere.
Yeah. We all have to appreciate it for, even if you only appreciate his later plays, you have to appreciate this one for giving you the later plays, so.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it, because we have gone on the long end of things.
Oh, no, I mean, you can't blame us. This play is just so jam-packed with so many things.
Yeah, definitely go read this and then come listen to the podcast again, and then we'll do, like, another hour just, like, talking about comments.
Yeah, oh, we should do a sequel. Maybe we could do, like, a year anniversary of Titus Andronicus. Like, wait a year and then reread it and see
what
else kind of engagement we get with it. That, we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's a lot of projection, but I thought we could do it.
All right, everyone. Well, if you liked this and you want to hear more like it, we have one other episode of Bardolatry, but the Minerva Podcast Network, which we officially are now because we have four podcasts, can all be found on our website at www.minervamag.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at MagMinerva, and we do have a Facebook page. So you can, you know, comment, tweet at us, do whatever. Any suggestions you have for any future Bardolatry episodes you'd like to hear, we'd love to hear what you think. And, yeah, feel free to go to the website and leave any comments on this particular one if you are not listening to it via the website for some reason. And I think, oh, and I guess the other thing I just wanted to mention really quick is we release one podcast a week every Thursday, and because we have four, that means Bardolatry is theoretically out once a month, although because some months have 5 weeks, that's not going to be 100% true all the time, but one episode out every 4 weeks, so that's something you can put in your calendar if you are looking forward to the next one. And I think with that, we can say goodbye. Thank you for calling in, Olivia.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm glad technology was accommodating and didn't bail out on us like I was afraid it was. And this is a great treat. I'm glad we know that this works now for future podcast fun time.
Yeah. And we will see you guys next time.
Bye.